Mr. Rubin?
May it please the court, Bert Rublin on behalf of Beneficial. Let me go first to the Metropolitan Club. I was at that meeting, and I don't want to belabor what's in the record, but I'd like to start first with what Judge Zagel found in his opinion. Page 13, footnote 13. Harris's testimony that Rublin threw out a number for purposes of illustration of 24 or 23 million is credible and not particularly suspicious. His testimony on this point is that Rublin was not making a proposal, and everyone seems to agree that no settlement offer was made by defendants at that lunch. There was no testimony by anyone, nor is there any record.
No one supposes that there was a settlement. The question is whether these lawyers were seriously representing a class or just trying to make whatever deal they could with Beneficial for the sake of their fees. That's the issue, and this Metropolitan Club meeting is obviously probative on that.
I think Mr. Kirby understandably downplayed the Metropolitan Club in his presentation this morning because of the timeline.
I don't think he did, actually. I thought he...
He did not want to emphasize it. Let me run through the timeline if I could run through the timeline to demonstrate that the Metropolitan Club meeting had nothing to do with the settlement that was ultimately achieved here. Nothing. First, the settlement was not reached until October 26, 1999, 25 months later. Second, they did not file a lawsuit until April of 1998, which was 7 months after the meeting. One would assume that if I had proposed $24 or $23 million, we would have seen a lawsuit in short order. It is not terribly difficult to find a plaintiff to bring these RAL cases. We've been defending these cases for 10 years. There are millions of RAL borrowers out there. If I had thrown out $23 or $24 million as an offer, I think we would have seen a lawsuit in short order. Third, the first offer that I made to Mr. Harris came on January 20th, 1999. That's uncontroverted. That was after I lost a motion to dismiss the Zawakowski case. I did not keep the Chicago case alive as a settlement vehicle to extinguish Mr. Kirby's case against Beneficial in New York. I filed a motion to dismiss the Chicago case. And when Judge Zawakowski ruled against me, I filed a motion for reconsideration. I wasn't trying to keep this case alive as a settlement vehicle. I was trying to knock it out. Mr. Kirby makes much of the fact that he had a case against Beneficial in New York in front of Judge Gershon, in which in August of 1998, she ruled against me on a motion to dismiss. I did not then call up Mr. Harris in August of 1998 saying, I've lost in New York, I've got to cash in my insurance policy, which is how Mr. Kirby characterizes it in his brief. Instead, I filed motions to dismiss Chicago. I did not use the Chicago case as a vehicle to settle New York. I moved to extinguish the very same case.
Mr. Rublin, I may have missed a beat here, but footnote 13 says Harris's testimony that Rublin threw out a number for purposes of illustration of $24 or $23 million is credible and not particularly suspicious. Are you arguing that you didn't throw out these numbers?
I swore an affidavit, as did Mr. Aducci, in which we both denied, A, throwing out any number,
I guess,
and B, making any offer.
Believe you.
But the point of the matter is...
What does it mean to throw out a number of $24 million as an illustration? What is that an illustration of?
It didn't happen, so I don't know what that would have been an illustration of. If it would have been,
you wanted to send this back to Judge Daigle so he can make findings about your credibility.
No,
and he says he believes the notion that you threw this out as an illustration is credible. It seems to me you have to defend that, and I'd like to know what it means to in a discussion with potential adversaries to throw out $24 million as an illustration. I'd like to know, what is it an illustration of?
That was Mr. Harris's testimony that I allegedly threw out the number as an illustration of a realistic, real-world number as opposed to $1 billion.
So it's made up of whole cloth.
Mr. Harris and I disagree about what was said at that meeting, okay? But what I want to do for the benefit of the court this morning is to demonstrate that the chronology The chronology of the negotiations does not...
An ordinary person reading Judge Daigle's opinion would say that you had suggested $24 million as a kind of ballpark settlement figure, and the lawyers go away, and sure enough, that's where we end up a couple of years later.
Your Honor, Mr. Harris and I differ on what was said, but I think what is most probative and most relevant is the history of the negotiations. What's relevant here is, A, Block was not at the meeting. There's no testimony by anyone that I had authorization to speak on behalf of Block. At the time of the meeting at the Metropolitan Club, there was only one case pending against Beneficial, which was...
But you seemed solicitous of Block, because how did Block get brought into the settlement?
Block got brought back into the settlement because Beneficial wanted global peace. If it was going to settle these cases, it wanted global peace.
Why do you want global peace? I can see why you want to have peace. You don't want to be sued. But why do you care whether H&R Block is sued?
The reason I care, Your Honor, is indemnification.
Why didn't you bring Mellon in?
Mellon was not involved as a potential pursuer of indemnification claims against us.
The only indemnification agreement.
But you wanted a globe.
Yes, and I would like to address that. The reason that Block got brought into the settlement negotiations is because we were concerned that there was a potential indemnification claim by Block against Beneficial. The initial settlement offer that I made to Mr. Harris in January 1999 was strictly on behalf of Beneficial. It wasn't until April of 1999 that Block enters the picture. That was because my client and I were concerned that for 10 years of row litigation against both of our clients, the clients have been exchanging indemnification demands with respect to each litigation that gets asserted. And for record purposes, let me direct the court to the complaint in the Zawakowski case, paragraph 20, which is in the Carnegie appendix, page 100, which makes reference to the indemnification. What happened is we were concerned that if Block gets an adverse verdict, not with saying that it's a 10-year track record, there's always the possibility when any of these cases might go to trial, albeit slim, that there might be an adverse verdict against Block. So we want global peace. Beneficial does not want to be on the hook indirectly to plaintiff classes who are just suing Block by way of an indemnification demand.
How are Block and Beneficial splitting the $25 million?
50-50. Block is not getting a free ride, and that's another point that was made that I'd like to address. When Block enters the settlement picture,
So in other words, you threw out, we were assuming, because we're, you know, you don't seem to want to have another hearing before Judge Daigle or another judge. So you throw out this $24 million as an illustration of possible settlement figure, but you end up paying only $12.5 million in the settlement.
Correct. All the more proof, I would submit, that the affidavit that I swore is in fact credible. But I don't think that credibility contest between Mr. Harris and I as to whether that number was thrown out or not is dispositive of this appeal.
Were any numbers thrown out during the settlement?
My sworn affidavit is no numbers were thrown out either by me or by Mr. Aducci. At the time, there was only one pending case against Beneficial. We had a pending motion to dismiss that we were sanguine about because we had constantly prevailed on truth in lending claims, similar to the one that Mr. Kirby brought. We prevailed in the Fourth Circuit in the Cades case. We prevailed before Judge Holderman in the Northern District of Illinois in the Beckett case. We prevailed in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. We were confident about it. We weren't worried about that case. I had previously, 2 months earlier, prevailed in the 11th Circuit on denial of class certification in the Buford case. I'd gotten a RICO claim blown out in the Christensen case in Georgia. There was not settlement pressure at that time. We came that morning from a settlement hearing, preliminary approval in the Jackson Hewitt case, where I settled the Jackson Hewitt case for $75,000 in counsel fees and $15 coupons. So I was not about to start making offers of $23 or $24 million. The point I'd like to get to is the Block. When Block comes into this settlement, the offer that's made to Mr. Harris is a $5 coupon. Locke's inclusion in the settlement negotiations means that the settlement goes from a $5 coupon in April of 1999 to $25 million in October of 1999. It cost a lot of extra money to have Locke as part of this settlement. With respect to the propriety, the legal propriety of including Locke in this settlement, I would direct the court to a case that's cited in the briefs, but given the mountain of briefs you have, I'd like to direct the court. It's a Ninth Circuit opinion that arises from the Whoops Securities debacle, Class Plaintiffs versus City of Seattle, 955 F 2nd, 1269. Relevant discussion starts at page 1287. In that case, the state of Washington was not a defendant in the federal court Whoops litigation because of the 11th Amendment. There is a certified state class action in which the state of Washington is a defendant. The state of Washington gets brought in, they pay $10 million, they get brought into the federal settlement, notwithstanding the fact that they could not have been sued and were not sued in the federal case. There are other cases similar to that, Eighth Circuit case, YNA Securities Group, 38 F 3rd, 380, 1994.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ms. Ellingsworth?
May it please the Court, Louise Ellingsworth for H&R Block. To address some of the previous questions from the panel, federal jurisdiction against Block was in existence at the time the injunction was issued dealing with the Texas notice. The amended complaint had been filed in November of 1999 and included a RICO count against Block. The injunction as to the Texas notice was issued February of 2000. And in terms of the Alabama Unfair Trade Practices Act, in fact, statutory language prohibits those damages from being recovered in a class action. And I'd also like to direct the Court's attention to Carnegie Appendix 364, which contains the paragraph of the indemnification agreement between Block and Beneficial Now Household that would require Block's inclusion in a settlement.
Beneficial is required to indemnify Block?
As to those claims that would involve the loan process, that's correct. And that specific indemnification agreement is not only quoted in the Zawakowski original complaint, but it is also attached to the Carnegie Appendix. If I could address the Hayes claim in terms of the Texas group, the settlement is fair and reasonable as to Texas because the claim in Texas was a breach of fiduciary duty claim pursuant to a confidential relationship statute in Texas. And Texas counsel admitted in colloquy with Judge Zagel that that was an uphill battle. Not only would...
Well, let's talk about what an uphill battle. Suppose the uphill battle succeeded, what would be the potential damages?
Well, the potential damages constitutes the second uphill battle because the
Well, ask my question. What would the potential damages be?
Texas counsel is claiming total disgorgement of all profits.
Now, what would that be?
Your Honor, I do not have a figure on the top of my head, and it's hard to know what you
Well, how many people are involved? How many borrowers are there?
In the state of Texas, Your Honor, over a certain class period. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I do not have
Well, I don't understand how you can talk about uphill struggles if you don't know what the stakes in the litigation are.
Well, my reference to that...
Suppose there were $1 billion at stake, and there's a 10% chance of winning. That's certainly uphill, 10%. Still, that's $100 million expected value. Now, how can we analyze the reasonableness of this settlement if you can't tell us what the stakes are?
Well, I believe it's because Judge Zagel was able to analyze
that. Where did
that
Judge Zagel make these calculations?
In his July order, he found that Texas counsel had admitted that first he would have to find a fiduciary duty on behalf of tax preparers that had never been found in the state of Texas before.
Well, there's a Texas statute that covers what lawyers and
yes,
various
sir.
Specified groups, and there's some general language at the end, which the issue here is whether that could be extended to tax preparers.
Yes, Your Honor, there was no precedent that would lead that way.
And as far as damages are concerned, as I understand it, there's some possibility in Texas of forfeiture of all fees paid for everything, tax preparation, and so on. I don't Judge Posner is asking you is there any evaluation of the likelihood of that?
The appellants maintain
that coming into effect.
I believe the appellants maintain that it's up to $2 billion in Texas.
That is what they maintain. And Judge Zagel, in colloquy with Texas counsel, both admitted that the likelihood of total disgorgement or total forfeiture was very remote.
Perhaps, can we say 1%?
He did not quantify that possibility, Your Honor. And one has to assume that he factored that in when he found the Texas
settlement. Well, why should we assume that? There's no discussion of probability. Suppose it is 1%. 1% of $2 billion is $20 million.
I believe Judge Zagel, in his opinion, factored that not in terms of a quantifiable possibility, but instead against 10 years of litigation in which there had not been a finding that resulted in a judgment.
I don't understand that. The Texas case hadn't been tried. What difference does the history make? If they have a 1% chance of, well, I mean, obviously these figures are artificial, but all you said was they have an uphill struggle. Well, an uphill struggle is not 0%.
I don't see any
effort by Judge Zagel or by you to give us the information we would need to assess the significance of this Texas suit.
I would agree that there is not a quantifiable evaluation
of
that risk.
I mean, a state law in another state and gets swept into Chicago with the most casual assessment of the likelihood of its ever prevailing.
In fact, when Block was included in the settlement, the risks did go up. The amounts did go up. We went from a...
I don't think so. It went from $24 million to $25 million.
But in fact, it went from a payment, in terms of benefit to the class, it went from a coupon situation to straight cash to
the
class.
Well, it didn't really go to straight cash because these people agreed to a reversion. We don't know what that would be worth.
Your Honor, straight cash to the
class
member.
No, straight cash doesn't mean anything if there's a huge reversion. Could be worth even less than coupons.
Well,
these lawyers were willing to agree to that.
Your Honor, our...
Also, I don't understand this business of... Am I correct that each of the class members' relief is capped at $30?
Well, for single loan recipients...
Well, is it... Am I yes or no? $30, isn't it?
Well...
Even if the person had multiple loans.
If they had multiple loans, $30, but then...
That doesn't make any sense. Because if they have multiple loans, they have been injured by more than, $30. That's just for two loans.
There was some additional cash. There is additional cash that will go to those multiple RAL recipients, in terms of the spillover, any interest that accrues on the amount of the settlement fund during the entire claims process. So there is some additional cash that goes as well.
Let me ask you this. If the Peterson case concerns only rapid refunds, and this class action is limited to RAL, how can the Peterson action be included within this settlement?
I submit that the argument that was offered to this court recharacterizes the claim that was present before Judge Castillo at the time he entered summary judgment. In fact, Ms. Peterson applied for a loan. That was her initial process in the H&R Block office. Resulting effects were that she received a partial loan and the rest of her what would be loan amount was sent to her via a standard refund. So the payment to the Peterson class, they will receive payment. They are included in
class.
Well,
they receive the $15.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What does that have to do with their damages, though?
Well, the scope of the relief pertains to all claims relating to RAL.
But the $15 is based on these refund anticipation loans, not based on the rapid refund fraud, if that's what it was. So I don't get it.
Well, I would submit that it is one entire umbrella, and that the rapid refund claim is encompassed within.
But it doesn't have. But the relief that they're getting is relief based on a completely different wrong that was done to other people. I don't get it.
In fact, I believe Judge Castillo factored what the relief would be to the Peterson class, and I'm sorry I'm not able to cite you to the footnote within Judge Castillo's summary judgment, but I believe he calculated what that damage would be, and my recollection is that the $15 to the Peterson class exceeds the amount that Judge Castillo calculated in his summary judgment.
So they're overcompensated.
Your Honor, they receive compensation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Ellingson.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you to all counsel. Do they have rebuttal time? Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have any questions? Okay. Thank you. We don't have any questions.
Your Honor, I also have 1 minute of rebuttal, but I'm not going to take it unless there are questions. So why don't you, Mr. Kirby, ask him?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, well, thank you to all sides. And our next piece of the litigation is called Mitchell versus Beneficial National Bank and Mr. Ungstreich again.
May it please the Court, this relates to Judge Daigle's denial of Mrs. Mitchell's intervention on the basis that we were adequately represented, not by the plaintiff's counsel in this case, but by Mr. Karstoffen and Mr. Kirby, who would adequately make the arguments before this Court. I must confess they made adequate arguments before the Court. The fact, however, is that applying the rubrics of this Court, liberal intervention is the rule, absent an untimely submission. We submit that the requests for intervention brought by Mrs. Mitchell and by Tommy Jones and Tommy Vaughn from Florida, the Westfall objectors from Illinois, and Don Alonzo from Pennsylvania, all were timely filed, and applying this Court's reasoning that intervention should be liberally granted, that's what the Court should have done. The Court never addressed the issue of the adequacy of representation of the plaintiff's counsel, and I want to put that off for a second. The adequacy of the Carnegie case and the adequacy of the Hazy case as it relates to Mrs. Mitchell and the other objectors. As the Court is aware, Mr. Kirby brought suit against Beneficial and the Black defendants in Carnegie. Mrs. Mitchell only brought her action in Alabama against the Black defendants. She was a Mellon refund anticipation loan customer, obviously not suing Beneficial for that reason. In Hazy, you have a very different state statute that the theory was brought about on, and therefore, as this Court has done during the argument on the merits of the appeal, has raised questions as to whether or not that case should have been swept in. Well, similarly, there are different state statutes and state issues as to Alabama, as to Pennsylvania, as to Maryland.
If we accept your argument, would that mean that the Court would have to allow interveners from all 50 states in order to properly protect the interests of all class members because every state has a different law?
No, I think that if the arguments are strictly related to common law issues of fiduciary duty and agency, as opposed to the HOTC issue, which is a specific statute which the other states do not have, you wouldn't need to do that. And I'm not advocating that you need 50 state interveners to raise the issues. I am raising the question of whether or not when the tail are RICO and a RICO claim that is drafted by H&R Block in the Zawakowski case, because the record in this case demonstrates that the drafted amended complaint after the settlement was sent to Mrs. Ellingsworth, or Ms. Ellingsworth, to revise and rewrite it, and she did in fact do that to make certain that all of these claims were there, that the tail truly is a federal claim. These are state law claims that were advanced against Block, and unlike the analysis that was done in Mexico Money, no analysis was done as to the viability of state law claims against Block. In fact, Judge Daigle paid lip service to it. So that relates to the adequacy of the Carnegie and Hazy counsel to advance the claims that Mrs. Mitchell wanted to advance. The court heard the arguments. We did it in a different fashion, with intervention coming second. I assume that's because this court believes liberal intervention should be granted.
You're relying on the Crawford case for that proposition?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that mean we just have to automatically grant intervention to everybody? Is that your position?
If
is there any discretion left in the trial judge?
Yes, there is discretion. There are other factors, and I'm suggesting that when you look at the factors to be applied, as it relates
well,
to the evidence.
Your position isn't, you said it's still discretionary whether people can intervene.
That's correct. As to whether or not there truly is an adequacy of representation. Here the court never addressed the adequacy of the representation of the plaintiff's counsel. I think that's because the court recognized that there was no way these plaintiff's counsel could possibly adequately advance the argument that Mrs. Mitchell wanted to address, and that is that it was in fact an inadequate settlement from the perspective of claimants having claims against.
But you were allowed to participate in the hearing as to the adequacy of the settlement, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But, Your Honor, if in fact the argument turns out that this court believes that the settlement should be remanded so that Texas and only Texas, because of the unique statute that Texas had, should be carved out of the settlement, then certainly that does not benefit Mrs. Mitchell and the claims that she wanted to advance in Alabama. And if we were not permitted to make those arguments before this court, certainly there was a possibility that the full ramifications of a remand, if the court believes the settlement was inadequate in totality, might not have been addressed. In addition to that, there's some potential problem in a view of this Beneficial and H&R Block settlement picture and this claim of indemnification. The court ought to know that a lot of the testimony of Mr. Rublin made in this courtroom was precluded from being taken in the court below. Attempts were made to depose all of the counsel for the plaintiffs and defendants in that case, and Judge Daigle would only allow us to take the deposition of the, quote, architects of the settlement. That happened to be Mr. Aducci and Mr. Harris. No one else was permitted to be deposed. The issues of what was in Mr. Rublin's mind and why he did what he did, as articulated before this court, was something that was not permitted to be explored. Part of the arguments that we made in our brief with respect to the evidence that was before Judge Daigle, if the court addresses our brief that we filed after
did
we...
Did you complain about Mr. Rublin in your brief specifically?
No, Your Honor, what we complain about, quite frankly, is the fact that as a result of the fee dispute between the plaintiff's counsel, information has come to light as to, quote, who the real architects were or alleged architects of the settlement. Disputes between them as to who did what and who knew what, when only Mr. Harris and not Mr. Prosnitz and not Mr. Miller and not Ms. Schwartz were permitted to be deposed, all of the now finger-pointing that has been brought out in these briefs were precluded from us, which goes to the adequacy of these counsel.
Why didn't you bring forth any witnesses for the hearing?
We didn't bring forth any witnesses for the hearing, quite frankly, because the burden of proof is upon the proponent of a settlement to present the adequacy and fairness and reasonableness of it through witnesses, through testimony, and we believe that the narrative of Dr. Adler was inadmissible evidence. No other evidence, no testimony, no affidavits, nothing was presented in that hearing. Effectively, what Judge Daigle said was, I've been waiting for all these years in a class action case to have a case presented to me. Mr. Kirby told me as an objector that he could come in with witnesses and evidence and prove the case against Locke. This may be my day for it. The fact of the matter, unfortunately, is that that's not the process for a fairness hearing. The first burden is upon the plaintiff, and the plaintiffs came forward. Neither the plaintiffs nor Block came forward with one piece of evidence to present to Judge Daigle to support a fairness and reasonableness of this settlement. And the only thing that they offered
was Dr. Adler's narrative, where he came up with a figure of $60 million, which was predicated upon fees that are not the fees at issue in Hazy, in Basile, in Mitchell, in Green, in Carnegie. Those are not the fees. Nobody's challenged those documentation fees.
So is it your position that you had witnesses waiting in the wings, but when nothing came up that you needed to respond to, you didn't bring
them? No, Your Honor, we submitted deposition testimony of Block personnel and offered that to show the viability and reasonableness of the settlement, even though that wasn't our burden.
Dr. Adler discounted the fees that you're referring to, though, didn't he?
Dr. Adler did that because, as the plaintiff's counsel professed to Judge Zagel and have professed here, there's no such claims. So when you are instructed by the attorneys to come forward with a damage analysis, you do it based upon the theories that support the settlement that they want to advocate. And that is very clear. In fact, Ms. Schwartz, in her brief to this court, said that she asked Dr. Adler if he could justify a $20 million fee. And according to her, Dr. Adler said yes, only if $13 went to every class member without a proof of claim by check. That was at least her representation in her brief to this court. So I'm not certain exactly what Dr. Adler was asked or was not asked, but at least the attorneys who have advanced the argument before this court never believed that the fees that we presented to Judge Zagel, and we did give him ramifications, we did give him parameters. For example, in the Basile case with 600,000 claimants and a $100 minimum UDAP claim, that's $60 million, just for a limited Pennsylvania class of 4 years. So we gave him those parameters. And we gave him the parameters of the license fees, and we gave him the parameters of the pooling arrangement. The issue goes to whether or not other fees get disgorged, but at least those fees were there, and they're 10 times, at a minimum, the amount that could be pointed to for Block's payment. And again, this case had $20 million on the table before Block was there and wound up at $25 million. How beneficial in Block shares it really is of no moment. It's how much of a benefit was achieved. And none of the plaintiffs got a penny more in settlement for not carving out Maryland, Texas, the full state of Pennsylvania, or New York.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Lango?
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent a gentleman named Roy Carbajal, who back in January of 2000 filed a putative class action in connection with the practices of denying RAL loans, receiving the tax refund anyway, and then using some of that money to offset money allegedly owed to other RAL lenders. Evidently, Household Bank and Bank One and a bunch, and Santa Barbara Bank and a bunch of the RAL lenders have this agreement among each other that what they will do is that they will accept a RAL application, deny the application for the loan if you owe money to any of these RAL loans in the past, proceed to accept the refund electronically anyway, and then go and give the money to one of the prior lenders. With Roy Carbajal, he was expecting a refund of $5,000, but he only got a refund of about $2,000 because Household gave $3,000 of his money to Bank One in connection with some old
RAL. Brief, you quote from the documents that this is an authorized notion.
Arguably, it's authorized. Of course, we never got the opportunity to litigate or conduct discovery or do anything in respect to that, or even contest the arbitration clause, which exists in the loan agreement.
Do your clients get the $15 also, 15 or the 30?
Yes, and Mr. Carbajal, and that's what happened. Mr. Carbajal got a class notice of settlement, and you know he called us up and he was like, "What's this?" That happened in June. We moved to intervene in order to interpret the scope of the release because our claims arise under the FDCPA for the debt collection practices of each of these RAL lenders and under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. Because when a credit application is denied, a notice needs to go out stating the reason. And if the RAL application was denied because you owed a prior RAL lender money, then the class member should have been notified of that, and then maybe they could have done something to revoke the electronic payment and not had the offset. So these issues were completely different.
Would you agree that the language of settlement is so broad that it arguably includes your situation, Mr. Parabell's situation?
Absolutely, and that's what we sought Judge Zagel to rule on, and he, without really analyzing Mr. Carbajal's claims at all, said, I decline to interpret the scope of the release at this time, and denied the motion to intervene on the grounds that Carbajal's interests were adequately protected by Kirby. But of course,
Final judgment that you're appealing from?
We're appealing from the denial of the motion to intervene, and then we have a contingent appeal on the scope of the release, asking that the release, which is so broad...
Well, all you got from the judge was a statement that he was inclined to do something, isn't that right?
Well, when he said that he was not going to interpret the scope of the release, we actually went in on a motion to actually have him determine that Carbajal's claims were not within the scope of the release. And the defendant said, because of our appeal of the denial of intervention, the jurisdiction in the district court was deprived. And in order to seek a remand from this court under Circuit Rule 57, Judge Zagel would have had to have said that he was inclined to grant our motion and would have been inclined to rule that Carbajal's claims were...
Well, we're told that he ever got to a resolution, though.
Well, he refused to give us that...
That's not a final judgment, is it?
He refused to give us that finding. He refused to say that he was inclined to grant our motion and exclude Mr. Carbajal's claims from the scope of the release. So in view of that, we couldn't get the limited remand to allow him to make that finding, and indeed... He indicated that based on the fact that he denied the motion as it relates to Ms. Peterson and that he felt that Carbajal's claims would go a similar way of Peterson, that they, you know, would be bound up in that release. So we're kind of here, you know, we haven't been involved in the Rao litigation. We have our own claims that we think are meritorious and that we would like to be given the opportunity to pursue, but because it's an incredibly broad release that goes back 15 years, it's anyone that obtained a Rao loan between 1987 and 1999 is encompassed in this. So, I mean, Mr. Carbajal, you know, obtained a Rao loan many, many years ago, evidently from Bank One, which was the one that he allegedly owed some money on. But his claims stem not from obtaining a Rao loan, but from having a Rao loan denied. His Rao loan that he sought from H&R Block in 1999 was denied. He never obtained the loan, but he never got his refund either. And we think those claims are meritorious, and we would ask that the court reverse the decision on intervention and then on the contingent appeal determine that the Carbajal claims are not within the scope of the release. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Langone.